bringing into session today's House Revenue Committee. We're going to hear about tobacco tax enforcement. Paul, you want to tell us background?
Madam Vice Chair, the tobacco, the Oregon Tobacco Task Force was actually formed in 2001, the 2001 legislature, to try to improve enforcement of the cigarette tax. One of the issues that we've had over the last, 10 years or so is when we look at our taxed revenue coming in from the sale of cigarettes, we get those that are stamped and legally sold. So we've tracked that revenue. It has fallen. Smoke sales per capita have fallen, as Mazin has told you, pretty much consistently over time. We know, of course, that prices have gone up significantly, both in terms of the cigarette taxes in Oregon, but also in terms of the master settlement, which really translated into significant increases on a per-pack basis. So you've seen really a doubling in cigarette prices in recent years. But there was a concern, and it was expressed before the Revenue Committee, certainly in the 01 session, that there was some unstamped cigarette sales that were taking place. There was those that had gone beyond enforcement of the Department of Revenue. So the proposal was to increase the presence of enforcement. There was a task force formed with the Department of Justice, State Police, and the Revenue Department. The revenue projections at that time were estimated to, believe I believe, about $9 million in 01. Those revenues came in. In 2003, the resources available to the task force were increased significantly and became part of the Department of Revenue's budget. Those dollars, however, on the cigarette side did not materialize. However, there was significant increases in revenue from other tobacco products. So we've asked, the chair has asked that the task force come before the committee and describe their findings and where they see things now. And we have Pete Shepard from the Department of Justice here to talk about the findings and recommendations for how to proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Shepard.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepard. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. The Department of Justice makes up one of the three legs of the task force, as you've just heard from your staff. The others are the Department of Revenue and the Oregon State Police, both of our other partners are represented here, and I'm going to turn to them liberally as the committee may ask questions that require some specialized expertise in one or another aspect of the activity. The invitation that we received was to essentially give the committee sort of an overall orientation about the task force and its work, and then be prepared to answer questions about it. These are issues that we've been, you and your predecessors have been working with over quite a number of years now. And I, in the course of helping you and your predecessors work through these issues in the past, it's become useful, I think, it's become apparent to me that it's perhaps useful from your side of the table to step back just for a second and be aware of two other parts of the tobacco picture that are easily mixed up in the question of the tax revenue collections. Mr. Warner mentioned one of those. That's the Master Settlement Agreement, or sometimes referred to as the MSA. And the other of those, what he didn't mention, but is tangentially related to both the Master Settlement Agreement and the tax collection question, is the NPM, or Non-Participating Manufacturer Law. And so in giving you, fulfilling my pledge to give you an orientation about the task force, I'm going to first start by telling you a little bit about the Master Settlement Agreement and the NPM law so that you can understand how those relate or do not relate to the tax collection issue. The Master Settlement Agreement is, of course, the instrument by which the lawsuits that Oregon and every other state brought against the tobacco manufacturers. And the Master Settlement Agreement, or MSA, is the settlement document that governs that. It's a contract, in effect, a settlement agreement between Oregon and the companies that were participating in the litigation and companies that subsequently have joined in the Master Settlement Agreement. It secures two kinds of benefits for Oregon, one of them being particularly pertinent to this committee's charge, and that's a financial benefit in the form of annual payments that are due collectively from the manufacturers to the states and received by the states generally in April of each year. The other kind of benefit, of course, is I know of concern to many members of the Assembly, but perhaps not directly related to this committee's charge, are the public health benefits that are secured by the Master Settlement Agreement, because it requires companies that are subject to its terms to adhere to certain restrictions on their conduct aimed at preventing a recurrence of the conduct that we saw in before the lawsuits, in which companies intentionally targeted kids with their product and so forth. Through the Master Settlement Agreement, we're able to impose restrictions on those practices that we couldn't have imposed in the absence of the Master Settlement Agreement. For instance, we can prevent those companies who participate in the Master Settlement Agreement from advertising in magazines that are aimed primarily at youth markets. But I want to focus, of course, on the financial aspects, because that's clearly something that this committee has the most direct charge over. And one thing to recall about the Master Settlement Agreement proceeds, those payments that are due in April, received in April of each year, is that they're extremely variable. And that's an important consideration, I think, for policymakers, in as much as we don't have a lot of control over the amount that's going to be received each year, nor do we have really excellent tools for predicting the amounts. We can get closer and closer to a more certain projection of how much we'll receive each year as we approach that date on which the payments are due. But there are a great many variables that go into the calculation of what the companies pay. One of those big variables is the volume of market share that those companies enjoy or control. And that controls a very large amount of the determination of the size of the payment that Oregon receives each Oregon and the other states receive each year. Now, as Mr. Warner has indicated, the fact of the Master Settlement Agreement imposes costs on the companies that participate in it. The most direct one is that they have to make the payments under the Master Settlement Agreement. But in addition to that, they have to comply with the marketing and other restrictions that are aimed at achieving the public health benefits. Those have costs associated with them. There's no question about that. So the concept of the Master Settlement Agreement was coupled in its original inception with the second of the topics that I wanted to talk with you about, and that's the NPM, or non-participating manufacturer law. And the reason it's coupled is that in order to level the playing field from the state standpoint, to drive as many manufacturers as possible into the umbrella of the Master Settlement Agreement, even those companies that might have joined the marketplace after the Master Settlement Agreement was entered into, we wanted to have a level playing field financially so that there wouldn't be any financial advantage to staying outside of the Master Settlement Agreement framework. And so Oregon, and I believe every other state except for the six that had settled their lawsuits before the Master Settlement Agreement was entered into, adopted what's called the Non-Participating Manufacturer Law. And the basic theory of that law is that every manufacturer that doesn't join in the Master Settlement Agreement, by definition a non-participating manufacturer, must pay into an escrow account an amount of money that is intended to approximate the amount of money that the company would have had to pay if it had joined the Master Settlement Agreement to create that level playing field. Now, it's important, I think, to understand that the monies that are paid under the NPM law are not revenues to the state of Oregon. They're paid into private escrow accounts that the company holds. And the theory is that those are held in that account for a period of years so as to deprive that company of the beneficial use of those resources and thus level the playing field as between the MSA and the NPM manufacturers. But those are not themselves revenues. So the NPM law, unlike the MSA and unlike the tobacco tax laws, doesn't directly generate revenues for the state of Oregon. Nonetheless, we have a revenue-related interest in aggressive enforcement of the NPM law. And the reason for that is that one of the variables that determines how much Oregon receives is whether we have diligently enforced the NPM law. Because from the standpoint of the participating manufacturers, they want us to diligently enforce the NPM law so as to be sure that their competitors who are not participating in the Master Settlement Agreement incur the same kinds of costs, or approximately the same kinds of costs that they incur. And so in order to give states an incentive to diligently enforce those statutes, there is an adjustment that can apply to the amount of money that we receive under the Master Settlement Agreement if a state fails diligently to enforce its NPM law. And so you will hear from time to time in your discussions about these issues the question of enforcement of the NPM law and how that's related to generating revenues for the state of Oregon. And what you need to remember as policymakers is it isn't directly related, because remember, the NPM law just requires companies to pay into these escrow accounts. But it's very importantly related, because if we fail diligently to enforce the NPM law, Oregon, along with any other state that didn't diligently enforce its law, could get dinged in its receipt of the revenues under the MSA. Now, the extent of that penalty under the MSA for failing diligently to enforce our law is a very complicated formula. It depends a lot on what happens in other states relative to our state. But it's a very significant risk for states that fail diligently to enforce their law. The first payment to which any adjustment under the NPM law may be applied or may be claimed by manufacturers is the payment that's due in April of 2005. That payment, that adjustment that we expect may be claimed, is relatively small in relation to the total amount. But in April of 2006, right now we're expecting that the companies may make a claim. Again, we dispute that claim because we believe we have diligently enforced the statute in Oregon throughout the experience since the Master Settlement Agreement was entered into and the NPM law was adopted. But nonetheless, there's a lot of money at stake, and so we expect the companies to claim collectively now in April of 2006 perhaps as much as $1.1 billion in reduction in the payment that they otherwise would make under the Master Settlement Agreement. Now, again, how much of that, if any, that Oregon would experience in its share in the Master Settlement Agreement is so many steps down the road that no one can really confidently give you any estimate about it. But it's important to understand that variable that's operating here. That brings me then to the Tobacco Tax Compliance Task Force. It was formed, as your staff has indicated, originally in 2001. And it was aimed primarily at the collection of tobacco taxes and not at doing anything in relation to the Master Settlement Agreement, and only secondarily in helping to do some enforcement work on the NPM front. And I'll tell you a little bit about how that works in a bit. I think your committee has received a briefing previously on the amount of tobacco tax that's being collected and the mechanisms for that. Is that right, Ms. Roller? Yeah. So I won't go into those.
Yep, perfectly.
All right, very good. So you don't need to be reminded of the magnitude of the dollars here at issue. Something, as I understand it,
go ahead and remind
me. Something like $491 million, as I understand it, is the Department of Revenue's estimate for the upcoming biennium in terms of the total tobacco tax revenues, of which about $463 million is represented in potential cigarette tax collections, and about $42 million in what's called OTP, or other tobacco products, basically being everything except cigarettes. And I'll remind you also then that the way those taxes are collected is that under law, those taxes are actually owed by the individual consumers. And so you may have actually received some constituent mail from one constituent or another. I know the Attorney General has received such mail from constituents who say, gee whiz, we got a letter from the Tobacco Tax Compliance Task Force or from the Department of Revenue saying that they understand that I bought some cigarettes in an internet transaction, for example, and they have evidence that the tax wasn't paid on it. I never had to pay tax on this before. How come I have to pay it now? And the reason that consumers in Oregon don't see this tax in a direct way, in the sense of having to write a check to anybody for it or pay it, indeed, in an obvious way at the register, is that we collect these taxes, and the task force is aimed specifically at reinforcing the collection of taxes at the distributor level. Because for convenience, even though the taxes are paid by are owed under law by the individual consumer, they're collected for convenience from the distributor. And you think about the mechanics of trying to collect that tax from every individual consumer, it would be a pretty burdensome thing. And so we collect them from distributors. And on cigarettes, we collect them basically by selling stamps that the distributor then affixes to the product as it's sent out to be sold at brick-and-mortar retail locations. And on other tobacco products, we collect it by collecting money from the distributor based on what the distributor reports as his or her volume of product that is being sold and put into the distribution chain. So the tax, again, is owed by the consumers and collected at the distributor level. The task force created in 2001 was really a first in the nation effort to try and combine, to marry up the administrative and civil penalty authority that the Department of Revenue has under current law with the criminal prosecution and investigative powers that the Department of Justice and the Oregon State Police have. We weren't aware then, and I don't know how many since other states have joined in this model, models in which all of those different enforcement authorities were brought to bear in an integrated, combined arms approach. The idea being that we would use all of the investigative tools available to each of those different kinds of investigative entities, pool the resources that are available and the information that's collected, and then apply the remedy that seemed best fitted to the violations that were identified through that effort in order to induce compliance and to increase the deterrent footprint, if you will, in the marketplace. And so that has resulted in a wide array of kinds of enforcement action over time. I've already alluded to the fact that through federal law mechanism, we were able to identify some of the individuals to whom product was shipped by out-of-state shippers in a direct-to-consumer transaction facilitated by an internet site. And we were able to identify in some of those cases that the tax had not been paid by the out-of-state shipper, and so tax was still owing. In those cases, the enforcement mechanism, if you can call it that, was a letter to the consumer that said, you need to pay us this tax. In other cases, the Department of Revenue has used some of its investigative authority and civil penalty authority to begin looking at potentials for civil penalty imposition. I know Mr. Smith can give you more details on what's been done on that front. And then in a number of cases, we have actually indicted and in some cases already obtained convictions of individuals who, the distributors in this instance, who have violated the criminal statutes with respect to the non-payment of tax. Let me identify a couple of findings what the task force has found in the course of its work to date. First, the existence of the task force has allowed us, and more particularly, I would say, that our partners, the Department of Revenue particularly, to be able to do for the first time actual on-the-ground inspections of approximately 4,400 brick-and-mortar retail outlets of cigarette tobacco product sales in Oregon. That hadn't been done before. The existence of the task force permitted us to do that. And that permitted us for the first time to identify by inspection of the actual product as it is reaching consumers through that mechanism anyway, the brick-and-mortar mechanism, to identify the magnitude of the tax compliance, or to put differently, the tax non-compliance problem, at least in the area of cigarette tax collections. And there, very interestingly, we find that there is a very high level of cigarette tax compliance. Over 99%, I think, is the rate there. In other words, the actual on-the-ground inspection has revealed that, at least in the last couple of years, that compliance rate has been remarkably high. Higher, frankly, I think, than we would have predicted in 2001 when we launched into this effort. We also found, I think it's fair to say, that in the area of other tobacco products, OTP, that the amount of tax noncompliance was higher. And it's harder to measure that because of the different way that the taxes are collected. You can't as readily by an inspection of the product at the store, can't pick up the product at the store and determine that the tax was paid back at the distributor. That is to say, you can't look at the package of chewing tobacco in the retailer and ascertain, as you can for a package of cigarettes, that the distributor paid the tax because there is no stamp attached to the OTP package. And so the attack here, the examination here, has been focused on the distributor level. And in fact, during the lifetime of the task force, we have, as your staff has already alluded to, seen an increase in the amount of other tobacco products tax collected above that which was projected in May of 2003. And these projections are very, I want to give you a couple of cautions about these projections. And I'm sure you're already familiar with these kinds of projections from your experience to date in this assembly. But the first is that they are, after all, projections, and they depend on all kinds of variables like, you know, what other products are people taking up, to what extent are our efforts in the state to reduce tobacco consumption, which is, after all, a deadly and addictive product, and all of us, I know the Attorney General strongly feels that one of the important goals here is to reduce overall consumption, even recognizing that that's going to result in reduced revenue because of the reduced amount of the product. So there are great many variables that go into these kinds of projections. And again, Mr. Smith can talk to you more about how the Department of Revenue, the methodology that underlies these. But the other caution I want to give you is particularly apt in relation to the Tobacco Tax Compliance Task Force, and that is there is a very great temptation, I think, to try and draw a numeric or algebraic relationship between the amount of money that's expended on a tax enforcement effort and the amount of money that comes in at the back end as revenue. That is to say, when I tell you that the current revenue estimates are something between 7.5 and 9 million for OTP above what was previously projected in May of 2003, and then I tell you that the task force has focused on other tobacco products enforcement during that period of time, it's very natural for people to say, well, the cause of that increase is surely due to the task force's efforts. And I can't make that claim to you that it's exclusively due to that. It's the same kind of problem, I would say, that faces policymakers when we look at the question of how do you measure the significance of any deterrent in a law enforcement sense. If we add X number of police officers to the street, can we say, if the burglary rate goes down somewhat, that it's because we've added those police officers? We're measuring what didn't occur. In this case, we're measuring the taxes that weren't avoided by someone or sought to be avoided by someone and were paid instead. Now, I would tell you that I believe the task force believes that it has made a significant contribution to that. But I cannot give you an algebraic formula that will allow you to say, if we invest another $800,000 in X number of positions in the task force, that you're going to pay for that and by generating $10 million or $2 million of additional revenue. I can tell you that I believe that that will be the result. That is to say that you'll increase revenue if we attack this in a smart way. But I can't tell you that it's going to be X amount or Y amount. Let me tell you the third kind of finding that we have, and that'll segue into excuse me, I'm sorry, I'm
sure that isn't a smoker's cough.
Madam Chair, it is not. my physician has diagnosed it as Dutch elm disease, so it's not contagious unless you have roots. So the third area, I think, is I told you that the task force has not to date found a brick-and-mortar cigarette tax noncompliance problem, or at any rate, we're not measuring one at present. We have found that there has been an increase in OTP collections, and that's consistent with what we found in terms of some of our criminal convictions. Some of the criminal targets have been OTP distributors who were violating the law. The third thing, though, is that I think we have identified a significant area of tax noncompliance, and that's in the internet sales direct to consumers area. It's difficult to measure the volume of these transactions, but it appears to be a growing part of Oregon's market. These transactions take place when consumers go to a website. Frequently, the websites brazenly advertise that these are tax-free transactions, which they cannot be, in our judgment. The consumer places an order with the website, takes delivery. Frequently, that order, I should say, is paid for through the use of a credit card. In fact, almost invariably, that's the mechanism of payment. And I'll go back to that in a little bit in terms of some things that the task force is already doing to try and attack that problem. But then the consumer takes direct delivery of the product through frequently a common carrier like UPS or Federal Express or one of the other United States Postal Service. And we believe that these transactions represent a growing part of Oregon's the distribution of cigarettes, particularly in Oregon. And we believe that almost all of these transactions are done in violation of Oregon's tax laws. And that is the area that we think would merit some focused, continued attention by the task force, and as to which we proposed a couple of alternatives for, in effect, retaining a part of the task force that would be eliminated under the governor's recommended budget. More on that in just a second. Let me refer just for a second to these internet transactions and tell you just a little bit about what the task force is trying to do to attack those with our current resources. The vulnerable part of these transactions right now appears to be the credit card companies, and we've made a direct approach to the credit card companies to see if we can, for want of a better term, jawbone them into becoming allies of the states, and particularly of Oregon, in an effort to ensure that tax is collected on these transactions. We've done that tried to make use, leverage the influence of the National Association of Attorneys General. And I provided you with a copy of the letter that's been sent now to, I gave you the one that went to Visa, but there's been a similar letter sent to each of the major credit card companies. And it's our intention, it's attached to the materials that I provided to you. It's our intention by this effort to try and persuade these companies, frankly, to withhold their services from these internet sites until there can be adequate assurances that the states are able to collect tax on these transactions. The purveyors of these products and internet transactions, we believe, are required to be, under Oregon law, registered as Oregon distributors, just like the distributor that I understand you're going to visit on Friday on your field trip. And so these providers are no more or less subject to the requirement that they be distributors under Oregon law, in our view, than anyone who happens to be located here in the state. And until these distributors bring themselves into compliance with Oregon law, we're trying to induce the credit card companies not to facilitate these transactions. The Oregon Attorney General and a number of other attorneys general are going to meet privately with the representatives of some of these companies at an upcoming meeting later in March, and we hope to be able to report some positive results back from those transactions. In the meantime, we're also pursuing criminal charges against one of these internet distributors and have secured an indictment against that company. At the time, I believe it was the world's largest supplier of internet suppliers of cigarettes over the internet, and that charge has been filed and is pending. Let me say just a word about the funding for the task force. The task force funding is provided from taxes collected, cigarette taxes collected. The funding is received by the Department of Revenue. To the Department of Revenue, I believe it's treated as general fund, and to the Oregon State Police and the Department of Justice, we bill the Department of Revenue, and thus it's treated as other funds for purposes of supporting the efforts in the task force. In 2001, as your staff has indicated, the task force was originally created. In 2003, it was enlarged. The governor's recommended budget, in effect, calls for it to be returned to its 2001 size. And we've provided you in the report that I believe your staff has distributed to each of you, we provided you with some options to consider for policymakers to consider that would permit us to maintain and complete the carrying out of some of the enforcement actions that we've already undertaken, and also contain ideas for targeting a slightly enlarged version over the 2001 task force, but a much reduced version in comparison to the currently authorized position size of task force, specifically to target these internet transactions. Those options basically consist of two alternatives. One would add three positions above the governor's recommended budget, and one would add a total of six positions above the governor's recommended budget. We've been briefing our respective Ways and Means subcommittees on those issues, and have tried to keep particularly Ways and Means staff informed as the developments on those options. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, that's where I would stop with my overview and be available for questions.
Are there questions for Mr. Shepherd, members of the committee, Representative Olson?
Mr. Shepherd, thank you, Mr. Chair. I might have lost this during your presentation just now, but earlier you were discussing the MPM law, and I'm curious what the measurement is used to determine that the state has failed to diligently enforce that. I did not catch that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, I didn't give it, and part of the reason is that there really isn't we have not to date actually had a litigated challenge to any state's entitlement to receive the full master settlement agreement on the ground that state had failed diligently to enforce its NPM statute. And indeed, the phrase diligent enforcement comes from the master settlement agreement itself, which really doesn't specify anything about what it is that the state must do, or more precisely, what it must avoid not doing to avoid the reduction. The mechanism for determining whether a state has the next question might be then who is it who's going to decide that? And interestingly, that too is an uncertainty. There is because we haven't actually confronted this in a contested way with the companies as yet. There remains a potential for a dispute about what forum that issue would arise. One possibility is that it would be a matter that would have to be determined by arbitration under the terms of the master settlement agreement. Another possibility is that it would be an issue that would be brought before, in Oregon's case, the Oregon Circuit Court judge who approved the master settlement agreement in the first place. We just don't know yet the full answer to those questions. On that question and others related to the NPM law, we do a lot of coordination with the National Association of Attorneys General so as to try and have a uniform national approach, even though some of these issues are going in the end to be state-specific. So more to be said about that.
Representative Olson, is that responsive to your question?
Yeah, that's good. I have another question, though.
Please follow up.
Well, Mr. Shepherd, thank you again, Mr. Chair. You mentioned the compliance rate. Could you describe what you're using as a measurement for that? I mean, are the members from the state police going to kind of share that a little bit with us for what they're doing for that measurement, or are you in a position to be able to do that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, I actually think that most of the, if you're speaking of the cigarette tax compliance rate,
yes.
I think that those inspections were primarily done by Department of Revenue field agents that are part of the task force, and I don't know, perhaps, Mr. Smith, you'd like to address. I think it's not anything more complicated than actually picking up the packages in the store and looking at them. But
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Eric Smith, and I'm the manager of the tobacco tax program for the Department of Revenue. I won't object to testifying next to Mr. Shepherd because, as you can tell, I have a cold, too. So this testimony shouldn't be too hazardous. Mr. Chair, may I address Representative Olson's question?
Please.
We gathered statistics in our compliance investigations, which our research department analyzed, and we actually took some statistical samplings from the retail community and just had a specific focus for a period of time on some of our investigations to look at, for cigarettes, for example, how many retail establishments had any compliance concerns, and then if they did have a compliance concern where they found unstamped cigarettes, what was the amount or how many packs in that establishment were unstamped compared to the total packs of cigarettes in the establishment. So the two measures that we identified for cigarettes were, first, how many retailers across the state were out of compliance, and second, and I think most importantly, of all the packs of cigarettes that were in our sample, how many of those packs of cigarettes did not have a legitimate Oregon tax stamp? And we found that 99.92%, a significant portion of those packs, do have a legitimate Oregon tax stamp.
Representative, is that responsive?
That's okay. Good. Thank you.
Representative Boquist, recognized?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'd like to go back, Mr. Shepherd, so I make sure I understand your agency's funding model, actually, the task force funding model. You said Department of Revenue, Department of Justice, Oregon State Police. Could you just, I got two of three, and I won't mention where I failed, so just give me the recap again of how each of those agencies are funded.
The total funding for the task force is first received by the Department of Revenue from cigarette tax collections. And then both the Department of Justice and the Department of State Police, in effect, send bills to the Department of Revenue for the costs of the personnel who are associated with the task force. And those the Department of Revenue then reimburses, in effect, the Department of Justice and the Department of State Police for those expenses associated with the task force. So to the Department of Justice and the Department of State Police, those are other fund resources. And I think that the Department of Revenue treats those as general fund resources, that originally received monies as general fund resources.
Mr. Chair, in 2003, it was converted from general fund to other funds, so that now all of the Department of Revenue's efforts in the compliance effort for cigarette and tobacco tax are also other fund. Other funds have always been the way for paying for the other tobacco program. Cigarette administration has been paid by general fund until that time, and I believe there's a sunset on that funding mechanism in January of 2008, and so next session we'll be addressing with you whether to continue an other fund mechanism for the cigarette enforcement or whether it reverts back to a general fund funding for that program.
I have two follow-ups, Mr. Chair, if you'll indulge me. So what we're saying is Department of Revenue, Department of Justice, Oregon State Police, it's all other funds. It's not in the general fund budget, correct?
Representative, let me interrupt right there. Eric, are you prepared to tell us how that mechanism works? Can you define that mechanism? I think that's only fair that we do that right now, because you've got us. I've got a number of people that believe here that this doesn't cost the state anything. That it's a fund out there that people just reach into, and so please identify what happens.
It's not me, Mr. Chair.
Is it? No.
We need to identify a little better, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, I want it on the record where that money comes from.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm happy to give it my best effort, and I'll ask for assistance if I need it. There are two task forces, as was mentioned earlier. There's the initial task force that was established by the 2001 legislature, and at that time, the task force, as I mentioned, had the cigarette component of the task force paid by general fund and the other tobacco component of the task force paid by other fund. In the 2003 session, I believe it was House Bill 2368, converted the cigarette enforcement for the program from general fund to other fund for Task Force 1. And so that was 18 staff for all three agencies, 9 Department of Revenue, and 9 split between Department of Justice and State Police. Later in the session in 2003, Task Force 2 was created, which is the enhancement that Mr. Shepherd referenced later. And the funding for that task force was different. That funding was established based on a May 2003 forecast by the Office of Economic Analysis. And that funding was that if the department and the task force met the goals for meeting the May forecast for the 2003-05 biennium, there was $30 million above those goals that were going to be given, $5 million of that to the enhanced task force, and then another $25 million of that was actually going to the Department of Revenue to replace general funds that were also disappropriated from the department at that time. So it's a little bit complex. But as far as the 05-07 governor's recommended budget for the 05-07 session, it's back to task force one levels, completely funded from the other funds of cigarette and other tobacco. Those expenses come right off the top of that revenue stream to fund the task
force. So, colleagues, so that let me see if I can. First of all, there was some reach back to the general fund in order to bridge this through the emergency board through June of 2005. And this resource, had it been properly funded, and it's not the fault of the task force. It was a decision that was made in Ways and Means. They know how I feel about it. That's probably why I'm not down the bowels of the building on the other side. They said you go out and raise the money through basically what would normally be general fund money. From other tobacco products, you go ahead and find enough of the other tobacco products that you can get the tax up on the other tobacco products. Rather than converting that to general fund, you will expend that money to operate your own program. That's a rather, in my way of thinking, a rather perverse incentive, a way to try and gin up resources. It's a lot like it's a lot like a speed trap. It's very much like a speed trap. Nothing wrong with speed traps. Representative Olson, nothing wrong with speed traps.
So, we get a 5 minute. He doesn't even know what that means.
The Easter Bunny and speed trap. But it would have otherwise been general fund and then collected into the general fund and then used to operate the task force and. Unfortunately, there were some decisions made that really didn't make a great deal of good business decision or good business sense in my way of thinking. Representative Boquist, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now I have two more questions. So that I understand the funding model, Mr. Chair. We're saying that Task Force 1 presently has 18 FTE that's filled or thereabouts filled, and Task Force 2 has 27 FTE that's either filled or close to being filled. Is that correct, what we're saying, Mr. Shepherd? And
Mr. Chair, Representative Boquist, actually, I don't have an exact count on the number of positions in so-called Task Force 2, and let me just say a word about the terminology here. We can refer to them as Task Force 1 and Task Force 2, but all these folks all sit together. They're all in the same room. They're all sharing the same information. In the way I think of it operationally, it's all one task force, which is we've been really pleased with the partnership that we've been able to develop with the Department of Revenue and the State Police, and it's really a very integrated group. But to your question, Representative Boquist, for the Department of Justice, and I think it's also true of the Department of Revenue and the Department of State Police, when we became aware of the governor's recommended budget, recommended funding levels, essentially eliminating Task Force 2, all three agencies have responded, I think, very aggressively to try and manage our way down to the governor's recommended budget level by the end of the biennium. So for the Department of Justice's part, for example, we've had vacancies I think it's five positions in Task Force 2, and we've not filled any of those, and we've tried to make arrangements to try and, you know, hire from the positions that we do have filled and so forth. So I think all three agencies, I think it's accurate to say, all three agencies either have already achieved the governor's recommended budget level or are assuming that we're going to be placed at that. I would say that if the Assembly were to go with one of the options that we recommended, there would be a very modest reinstitution of a few of those positions. But all three agencies have responded to try and put us on a glide slope down to zero, in effect.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So now that I've set the whole thing up here, I guess my question is really fairly simple. I mean, it doesn't matter how we address this or what we call it. The governor or someone in the governor's staff believes that Task Force 2 ought to go. And so what is the rationale for eliminating the 27 positions?
Mr. Chair, Representative Boquist, it's not my purpose to advocate for the governor's budget here today. I have the luxury of working for an independently elected state official, and so I'm perhaps freer than the other executive branch agencies would be to express a view. We don't agree with the governor's recommendation on terms of funding for the task force. What we do think is that the size of the originally calibrated task force to those multiple positions was based on an assumption about the magnitude of cigarette tax noncompliance that, through the efforts of the task force, we've been able to determine is not accurate. We have a 99.92% compliance rate in that arena. And that's different than the hypothesis that this assembly operated on, and frankly that the task force did in 2003. And so I think that our view would be that there is merit in reducing the size of Task Force 2. We think, however, there is also merit, speaking now for the Department of Justice, there's a very strong case to be made for some real smart targeting of the internet part of this puzzle, because we think we can document that problem, and that the two options we presented to you would give us the option of pursuing that in a smart way. So that's Department of Justice's view on that question.
Thank you, Pete. Let me ask a couple of questions, and I was able to view your first portion of your presentation on the television in another part of the building. Does the Department of Justice have any position with regard to reselling tobacco? That is, when we see tobacco legally retailed in another state and then purchased by a reseller in Oregon and then restamped in Oregon and resold in Oregon. Do you see much of that in this process, or the folks that are involved in reselling, do you see them as any portion of your problems that you're dealing with, running into them again and again?
Mr. Chair, I defer to my colleagues on the task force for detailed answers to that. I think from a tax compliance standpoint, so long as the Oregon tax is paid, it's a law-compliant transaction.
Certainly.
So I think that...
Maybe we could get someone from the Oregon State Police up at the table and have someone respond to the fact that if you do in fact see any reselling going on, nobody wants to.
Mr. Chair, I'm Mike McKernan. I'm a sergeant with the Oregon State Police. I think that we do, probably in a number of areas, more so in other tobacco products and internet sales, where out-of-state companies are selling directly to distributors and other retail outlets. I think that there's a number of large corporations, excuse me, that are around the United States that deal in tobacco, that do sell to distributors and retailers.
Okay. Mike, do you see double-stamped tobacco in the process of any of the busts that you're doing?
Some. Rarely, though.
Okay. Let's go on to a little bit different. Do you see any other states enforcing any kind of a OTP or wet tobacco stamping?
I have seen some states enforce some tax regulations on OTP. I'm not exactly sure.
Any stamping similar to cigarette stamping?
Mr. Chair, we are not aware of any other states who are yet stamping some other tobacco products.
Any other tobacco products?
To our knowledge.
Cigars?
No, sir.
Okay. Good question. Why? Fair tobacco pricing. Pete, have you looked into the issue of potential fair tobacco pricing, and that comes back to the issue of what they bought it for and what they can sell it for?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I have been in contact with and had several discussions with a gentleman. I don't know whether it's his facility that you're going to visit on Friday or not, Mr. Kampf. And Mr. Kampf is a distributor, and Mr. Kampf is an Oregon-based distributor and business person who is in competition, fierce competition, with other distributors in Oregon. I think there's some 244 odd licensed distributors in Oregon, some of whom now include some very large players. Costco, for example, is apparently has a very big part of the distributor's market, and is, for a variety of reasons, apparently able to compete very aggressively in this marketplace. And Mr. Kampf has talked to the Department of Justice about the possibility of enacting some kind of a law which would, in Mr. Kampf's view, make it a fairer marketplace for him in relation to these very aggressive competitors who are able to sell for below what Mr. Kampf and certain of the smaller distributors, I take it, believe that they can sell their product for. Mr. Chair, the Department of Justice has not formulated any formal position on any such proposal. As you know, we've just indicated we'd be happy to serve as a technical resource at this point to Mr. Kampf or to the committee or the chair if you'd like us to help develop ideas for your consideration. But we haven't taken a policy position on any such proposal. And I would say that I would observe for the benefit of this committee that question is really, it's separate and apart from the tax collection question, because the contention in relation to the competitiveness of certain distributors as opposed to others in this respect is not that one distributor is gaining a competitive advantage over the other by avoiding the tax. It's through other market forces, but not through law noncompliance, which is what the task force is concerned with. So again, from the task force's standpoint, the tax that's collected from Costco is just as good as the tax collected from Mr. Kampf or from any other distributor.
Certainly. Thank you very much. We can come back and visit the issue. Does Oregon have any other fair trade pricing policies on gasoline? Or
Mr. Chair, I made some inquiries about that, and I've not been able to identify any other area of law in which the state, as a matter of state policy, has sought to implement the idea that we've been discussing.
Okay. And finally, this probably comes back to the Department of Revenue and the Department of State Police, and that is relative to surveillance. Are you using regularly with regard to the other tobacco products, recognizing that Oregon has a rather significant tax on other tobacco products, and there are places within just a few miles of the Oregon border where you will find no tax on other tobacco products, thus making it very attractive? What is the tax? Is it 65%? 65% of the wholesale price is the tax. So if we have someone, a business, buy the product in the state of Oregon and it costs a dollar, they send 65 cents to the Department of Revenue process as part of the tobacco tax. The question I have then is, if that same product can wholesale for a dollar even across the border, what kind of surveillance are we in the process of doing to bring that under compliance?
We do, Mr. Chair, we do regularly surveil some of those outlets. Primarily, we attempt to identify our targets before we do the surveillance at with the usual places, the Yakima Nation. And we frequently find Oregon businesses going to the Yakima Nation and purchasing products. The Yakima Nation are actually several smoke shops located in that. Take measures to stop our surveillance because they know that it's going on, and go to great lengths to aid their Oregon customers in violating Oregon's law.
So, Mike, if we had a tobacco shop in the state of Oregon, and had friends that had a Washington license plate van, then they could stop off at one of the low-cost or no-cost operations in Washington, fill up their van, and it would not be surveilled necessarily because it was a Washington state van. Is that...
I'm not sure I understood your question, Mr. Chair. Well, I think the answer is yes.
By disguising the purchases at Washington purchase, it would appear that there'd be no reason to surveil that. If the van subsequently left the surveillance place and switched all the product over to an Oregon licensed van or someone headed to Oregon, then the transactions escaped the surveillance at that point, I assume.
That's correct.
Okay. The question I have then is, how do you catch this other tobacco product, the failure to receive the tax on it? What's the standard operating procedure to zero in on that?
Well, I think, first of all, you have to identify suspects, and one of the things that our partner Department of Revenue has been very good at is contacting retailers and identifying products that suspect. Oregon has a strict invoice requirement law, and we encounter such things as inadequate invoices or a suspicious product count with old invoices, and that leads us to the revelation that maybe something's wrong here. At that point, it would be incumbent on law enforcement to further look into it and then identify the distribution ring that that's usually associated with that.
Mike, when you see that kind of white-collar crime, that kind of crime, which is basically a business crime at that particular point, are there other kinds of crimes that are normally associated with that when you go in to make the bust for that kind of a business?
You know, frequently there is. I think that if they're inclined to cheat in those taxes, they're inclined to cheat in a lot of ways. We found in serving search warrants some surprising information. A lot of these people carry firearms. We found some narcotics. So there are other things that we found that are associated with the people we serve search warrants on.
Mr. Chair. Yes, Representative Hass.
Thanks. I must be missing something here, but if someone buys cigarettes from Yakima Nation and comes down to sell them, they won't have the Oregon stamp on them.
This is other tobacco products which bears no stamps. That's the difficulty that we have here, is that other tobacco products have no stamps. Let me just, colleagues, share with you the issue of reselling. And I'm not sure how we get to the bottom of it. These folks are all certified smart out here and work full-time at this. And the reselling issue, unfortunately, a major tobacco company will cut a special deal for another state, for wholesalers in another state. And maybe that's a tobacco-raising state such as Kentucky. And I think Kentucky has been identified as one of the major reselling states. And we've talked about earlier, and Pete Shepard's testimony, talked about the master settlement agreement and how much money we anticipate and receive off from the master settlement agreement after that was settled, and even though we borrowed from that those proceeds. The process of reselling then is that a package of cigarettes which would be sold normally nationwide wholesale by a tobacco wholesaler, by a tobacco manufacturer, a brand name, might be $2 a pack, sold in Portland, Oregon to the wholesaler for $2 a pack plus freight, and $2 a pack in Kentucky. The tobacco company will then go out and give a spiff, or a special purchase allowance, to the tobacco purchasers in the state of Kentucky. And they might give a 70% price off on that tobacco because they're a raising state. And if the tobacco tax in Kentucky is 12 cents a pack as compared to a dollar and 18 cents?
$1.18
a pack. So if it's 12 or 18 cents a pack, then that's stamped in Kentucky. Now you got tobacco with a wholesale price now of under 50 cents a pack with a 12 cent stamp on it. And you can go back now and drive your truck back, an 18-wheeler back, totally legally, and drive up there and load up on this tobacco in Kentucky and bring it back to Oregon. And they could be one of these 244 Oregon Stamper distributors. That's who it would normally be that would be picking this up. They would bring that tobacco back to the state of Oregon. This is all brand name tobacco. And then they run it back through the stamping process. So it's got a double stamp on it. This is called reselling. Now, my question to the Department of Revenue and the Department of Justice, and Pete Shop runs this issue because it's very, very important to the state of Oregon. Pete, from the transaction that I just described to you, who gets the credit for the master settlement agreement as the seller of that tobacco? What state?
I'll have to go, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll have to check to make certain of this. But I believe the answer is that our Oregon share of the total amount, that Oregon share, that is to say the calculation and the amount, the total amount that the tobacco manufacturers collectively pay each in their annual payments is fixed in the master settlement agreement at 2-point-something% of the total amount that's received in each payment. And so the calculation of Oregon's share is based, I believe it's independent of the jurisdiction in which the sale takes place. I'll check that and make certain.
I would appreciate it if you do that. It's my understanding that our share of the settlement is only based upon the continued high volume of retail sales of the tobacco that's pushed through, and that under the Master Settlement Agreement, each state has to maintain the records of the amount of tobacco from the participating manufacturers that each is selling. And it's my further understanding that as a result of that, Kentucky becomes the state of first resale and would receive the benefit of the Master Settlement Agreement payment.
Mr. Chair, I think that's not quite correct.
Oh, okay.
Because I don't believe that, in fact, I'm certain that Oregon's share depends upon the market, a state-specific market share calculation. Oregon's total amount does depend upon the amount of market share in toto that the participating manufacturers have, but that's the national market share. Now, what the uncertainty I have about the answer to your question, though, Mr. Chair, and the thing I need to check out is whether, in some way, that would have an effect on how we would account for those sales at the NPM enforcement level, which then again can have an influence on the receipt of our share under the Master Settlement Agreement because of the diligent enforcement effort. And that's
because then the total of the cigarettes sold in Oregon would have a lesser percentage of the participating manufacturers, even though the brands may be from participating manufacturers.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think the way it would work, well, rather than just add speculation, let me get back.
Can you get back in writing to the committee? I would appreciate it. We'll share that all around. My concern is that there also is the potential of the fact that we've seen that those folks who have chosen to participate in reselling sometimes have a larger shelf content of non-participating manufacturers who are genuinely non-participating and who do not choose to participate in the other insurance programs or bonding programs the state of Oregon has demanded that they participate in. So I'm very anxious about that whole process, that as a result of some lapses in Oregon surveillance and the reselling laws that we allow some of this to come in. I'm also anxious about this other tobacco products issue that, as Mike indicates, you get some stale invoices that, you know, they're still selling the same wet tobacco from 6 months ago, and the shelves seem to be abundantly full, and people are coming in and pulling it off at a price that is ridiculously low in relationship to anybody else. So those are some of the concerns that I have. Please, Eric.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, on that point, I'd like to make you aware that the department is actively pursuing discussions with distributors about stamping technology for cigarettes and also the potential for stamping some of the other tobacco products. We have a meeting scheduled for March 9th in Portland. We've had a fairly good response from some of the larger distributors. I think we have at least 14 distributors confirmed looking to attend. We know that the technology that they have that you'll see Friday is ancient, but there's just one player in the cigarette stamping community. We also know that there are other vendors in the community with current technology. For example, the proposed printing using 2D barcoding at a distributor where you have an electronic fund transfer where we can authorize them to print stamps on site with the technology where we can go in and scan with the scanner. I mean, we're in that era, and we're getting some feedback from distributors that they would like to engage in that. I just share with that with you now because we hope to come into the 2007 session after spending some time looking at some options to maybe have some proposals. That technology might also lend itself to stamping some OTP that has consistent packaging, such as the moist snuff or chew. I don't think it would lend itself to all OTP, but we do know that a significant portion of OTP revenues is from that moist snuff and chew. So we are looking into options to get us into this century in terms of how to do stamping.
All right, Eric, I appreciate that, and I know that the Department of Revenue is always attempting to try and figure out what the leading technology is, and there's really very little reason for Oregon to be on the back end of the technology, the uses of this technology, when a lot of it is actually generated here in the state of Oregon. It's created. Representative Berger?
Yeah. Could you give us a little bit of a scale on what percentage of tobacco tax revenue is attributed to cigarettes as opposed to OTP? Just give us the... And also, I would love further discussion on what strategies for the internet issue. It seems so difficult to get at how to identify, how you find these sites, what are your strategies in that? Those are the two questions.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I'll address the first question and defer the second on internet to Mr. Shepherd. At the December forecast, in that forecast, cigarette revenues for this biennium, 03-05, were $463 million. Other tobacco revenues were $42 million for a total of $505 million. That was the forecast as of December. So, yeah, low 90%. So the majority of the revenues are still cigarette in terms of the mix in the revenue stream.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, to answer your second question, I've asked Steve Briggs. He's the chief counsel of our Criminal Justice Division, and he can give you an idea of the kind of strategies that we hope to employ to attack the internet providers. I would just remind you of the one vulnerability that we already have identified is this business of the credit card providers, and so we're trying to get at that lubricant for the...
My problem with that is they aren't who we're... We're going after somebody else to get to somebody else, and these folks are not the problem. The problem lies elsewhere, and I'm always uncomfortable with a strategy that attacks the wrong people,
sure,
if you will. And I understand that it's hard to reach those people, so that's the crux of my question.
Sure. I just want to make clear that we're not, we haven't returned indictments against any of the...
I understand that, but...
Against credit card companies.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Berger, we're adopting a number of different strategies to deal with the internet. First and most important, we think, is the outreach to the third-party facilitators for these internet providers. That involves credit card companies, PayPal, as Mr. Shepherd described, the distributors via mail, U.S. Postal Service, and so forth. And if they're conscious of criminal conduct, they do have some obligation under the law to assist us with regard to that. And so we're trying to make them aware of their obligations. And my understanding is the letter that went out was signed by 42 attorney generals of the United States, and that there's a meeting set for March. Additional strategies that we are pursuing is direct indictment of these internet distributors. We have one indictment returned in Oregon of an internet distributor who was located in Beaverton, and he has been charged with racketeering and a number of other additional crimes. and he's currently pending trial right now. Mr. Shepard also mentioned that we have indicted Oatly Media, formerly the world's largest internet distributor, based out of Switzerland. Along with indictments for criminal racketeering, we're considering several other options, including civil suits, requiring these internet distributors to comply with Oregon's law that requires all distributors to provide the names and addresses and quantities of the purchased amounts to the Department of Revenue. That would allow the Department of Revenue to collect the money, the tax owed, directly from the consumer. Now, to date, I'm confident in saying that almost no internet distributors are complying with their legal obligation under federal law and state law to provide that list of names of consumers to the Department of Revenue. So that provides us the opportunity to file civil suit. We have one in the works right now. In addition to that, we're also pursuing the possibility of civil racketeering laws. And each of these different revenues provide different avenues provide different benefits. And one of our main concerns is not only obtaining a criminal conviction, but making sure that there are assets out there that they can meet their obligations under the Oregon tax law. And it's one thing to take a person down and convict them. It's another thing to take them down, convict them, or obtain a judgment against them, and have your hands on the pool of money that they owe to the Oregon citizens. And that's our primary pursuit here.
Thank you. Wouldn't you have some of the same possibilities against shippers as you would with the credit card people? I mean, they have that relationship there. I mean, couldn't a similar letter be sent to UPS or FedEx?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hass, that's correct. In fact, we're pursuing that as well. That's a couple steps behind in the process. And that's, we have two lawyers that are dedicated to the task force from the Department of Justice, and one of our lawyers is spending a good amount of her time with regard to pursuing credit card companies and compliance from the common carriers.
Representative Boquist, recognized?
Mr. Chair, and I think it's more of a question for you because I don't want to take more time and go into this, but I think in regards to the fair market pricing issue, I think there's another issue that I know I'm interested in, and I believe Representative Olson is interested in, and I happen to have a little experience in smuggling. you know, in my line of work, with many of the members know, in my other life, I've dealt with this on the terrorism side, and of course, revenue runners predate the Constitution of the United States and the independence of this country. And I know for a fact that in the fair market pricing arena, that there are mechanisms in place, and out of this forum, I'd be happy to share with you, Mr. Chairman, but where you can bring product in. And then literally bring that product, basically smuggle it in, and then take it to the distributor or resell it from distributor to distributor, as you're saying, and then tax it. And it looks like it's taxed. It is taxed. It's the 99.2, am I correct? The 99.2 number, because they're paying taxes, but it's that fair market price. They basically smuggled it in, and now they're selling it. And they're selling it legally, and we're getting our taxes, but the bottom line is it's a smuggled product. They're just paying the taxes to launder the money. Mm-hmm. And no disrespect, but I know in the 30 years of business that I've been in what I do, we've had almost less than $10 million in success at this in almost 30 years. And so I'm just wondering if the point is, you know, where do we have, how can we address the smuggling issue? It's not Oregon, mind you, it's the border states. And it's not the southern border states. It's the northern border states that are allowing this to happen. And then it comes in and they resell the product. And, of course, they're meeting all your requirements. They're selling it. But I think it may be the invoicing. And I think that's something we need to explore a little bit more because it comes back to this fair market pricing. You don't necessarily need to be, you know, I don't want to mention a company, but one of the big companies giving it a discount. You can, in fact, be smuggling it in. Now, of course, one would have to generate, say, that how can you come out with an authentic pack of looking cigarettes? Now, that's a different story. That's got to do with international revenue runners, so on and so forth. But I think it's something that we might want to address at a later point and maybe in a smaller entity based to the sensitivity of it, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Boquist, it sounds like from what Eric is saying that the department is going to be pursuing some interim work relative to pricing and stamping and those kinds of things following some of this. And I would hope with the high technology we have that we'd be able to get a better handle on this, but if there is an interim committee that works on that or an interim work group, that might be place where you could share some of your skills and talents and background on smuggling. Other questions for the members of the task force that are here today? Colleagues, where we're raising $505 million through the tobacco efforts and probably losing nearly that much again in other illegal activities or potentially losing a goodly portion of that that we're not seeing in the revenues. I thought it was important that we have the task force come forward, and then we will be on Friday having an opportunity to actually go out and tour the what's it called? Is it CNS? Or CNE? Or anyway, the tobacco operation, the stamping operation of that's operated by the Camp family. So, let's see.
Just the address.
Just the address. 1120 Southeast Morrison Street. And I think I know the name of the operation, but I'm sorry, we're going to have to make those arrangements. So, colleagues, that will be at 1:30 mm-hmm. On Friday that we'll have an opportunity to be up there. We may need to pass that. Let's see, you each have a copy of the invitation from Alan Camp with the address. I think it should be at your desk.
Mr. Chair, I think that was that emailed?
No. Okay.
Okay. It was emailed to your office.
Okay.
So we can bring that tomorrow.
Okay.
As well.
He's the lucky one today.
I'm the lucky one? Okay. Are there members who cannot be in Portland on Friday that won't be joining us at the tobacco wholesaler? You get the all you can eat.
Great.
Colleagues, I just encourage and invite you to participate, and Mr. Camp has also asked that any members of the staff that would like to participate and be there can certainly do that. And again, I think that with regard to the small stampers, these are non-chain store stampers, I think the Alan Camp operation up there processes something like about a third, he and one other process about a third of all of the tobacco in the Portland area that doesn't come through chain stores. So it's a pretty good sized operation. With that, if there's no further issues, let's see. Paul,
can I make another schedule?
You bet.
I just want to point out to the committee for next week, and the chair and I will be finalizing the schedule for next week, but the revenue forecast will be released next Friday, the 25th, and that will be released at the in this room. It would be a meeting of the Senate Revenue Committee, but it will be a joint meeting with the Senate. So both Senate and House Revenue Committees here at 9 in the morning on Friday, the 25th. So that will get an update on the general fund revenue picture, as well as I'm not sure what they'll do, but in terms of interpreting where lottery revenue will be after yesterday's announcement.
Yes, interesting.
Just for your information, Chair, my other committee will be in the Dalles on that day, so I won't be here that day.
On Friday the
25th.
Okay. We will have you bring a note from Mother if you would,
yep.
Please. Okay, Representative Haas?
Yes, us three were going to get together today, but there were some school people who wanted to do it tomorrow instead to talk over the school formula at 2:30. That's okay.
Tomorrow.
Or as soon as we're done.
Excellent. And let's see, I think we have John Marshall and Chuck Bennett that are offering their services and are willing to meet with any individual members. And I spent 2 hours with them last night, very productive time, just going through each element of the formula. And I tell you what, once I can see it on a tax return, and that's what it is, it's a little tax return report that they reconcile with, it starts to make some sense. And I found that very, very, very productive. Could ask questions about what happens if, and then, mm-hmm. You know, those kinds of things. And these people, and they'll bring the other experts to the table to help us out. But I think this is very important for us to understand all of the intricacies of the school funding formula and the other issues that we'll be studying as we continue to proceed forward. With that, we'll go ahead and close our meeting for today. Thank you very much.